Our next speaker is Charlene Mitchell.
Well, I want to thank the organizers of this most important conference. And I'm pleased to share this session on Malcolm X and Black Perspectives on the Crisis of Socialism with others who share a commitment to Black liberation and social progress. Sisters and brothers, or as Malcolm would have said, sisters and brothers, friends and enemies, I would like to address the issue of the crisis in socialism by placing it within the context of the development of the three major progressive forces of our time. The working class and oppressed nationalities of the developed countries, the national liberation movements of the developing countries, and the socialist countries. It was within the context of these three forces that Malcolm appeared on the political scene. If one of Malcolm's contributions was the linking of the African American struggle with the struggle of the emerging national liberation movements, the internationalizing of the struggle, as it's been called, this took place in the context of the one of Malcolm's contributions was the linking of the African American struggle with the struggle of the emerging national liberation movements, the internationalizing of the struggle, as it's been called. This took place in the context of the interaction and intersection of these three forces. The crisis in socialism has been extremely deleterious to the other two forces. This could not be any other way, because they are all three very much linked. But the crisis in socialism itself is taking place within a definite context. The last decade marked by a sustained assault by imperialism on the three forces of progress. And fortunately, imperialism, and unfortunately, imperialism has been very successful. Domestically, the Reagan-Bush era has facilitated a most dramatic transference of wealth from the working people to the wealthy. This has been accompanied by a general decline in the living standard of the working people in this country. And as can be expected, due to racism and national oppression, oppressed nationalities suffer the brunt of these policies. The African-American community is in crisis. Recent reports indicate that a majority of African-American children are born into single-parent households. Given the current economic realities, these children are doomed to a life of poverty and want. What are these economic realities? Obviously, there is no inherent reason why a child born to a single-parent household would be likely to face a lifetime of poverty. But the impoverishment of the working class has increased so much that it takes a two-paycheck family to survive at the level that a one-paycheck family was able to do 20 years ago. That many of these single parents are women facing sexual discrimination in the marketplace compounds the problem. Other reports indicate that 12% of African-American children are living with their grandparents. This is very often due to drug abuse by their parents. The weakening of family combined with drug abuse, homelessness, AIDS, and other social ills is unraveling the very social fabric of the African-American community. And it is this social fabric, strong families in particular, that has allowed us to survive centuries of oppression in this country. But oppressed nationalities are not suffering alone. The working class, particularly its organized sector, of which African-Americans are disproportionately represented, are also feeling the brunt of the policies of the Reagan-Bush administration. Beginning with the breaking of airline controller strike by the just inaugurated Reagan administration, the last 10 years has witnessed a ruthless assault on the organized labor movement. The percentage of workers who are organized is declining, while regulations and rulings passed by the National Labor Relations Board make it extremely difficult to win a union organizing drive. The hiring of so-called permanent replacement workers, scabs if you will, has nearly negated the strike weapon, taken from organized labor one of its most potent weapons. Lest it be unclear, let me state that when we talk about organized labor, we're not just talking about white workers. We're talking about African Americans, Latino, and other oppressed workers as well. An attack on the rights of labor is simultaneously an attack on African-American workers. While this attack on the living conditions of the people has been going on, the Reagan-Bush administrations have been packing the federal judiciary, not just the Supreme Court, with right-wing ideologues, including some weird, peculiar organized sector, of which African-Americans are disproportionately represented, are also feeling the brunt of the policies of the Reagan-Bush administrations. Beginning with the breaking of airline controller strike by the just-inaugurated Reagan administration, the last 10 years has witnessed a ruthless assault on the organized labor movement. The percentage of workers who are organized is declining, while regulations and rulings passed by the National Labor Relations Board make it extremely difficult to win a union organizing drive. The hiring of so-called permanent replacement workers, scabs if you will, has nearly negated the strike weapon, taken from organized labor one of its most potent weapons. Lest it be unclear, let me state that when we talk about organized labor, we're not just talking about white workers. We're talking about African Americans, Latino, and other oppressed workers as well. An attack on the rights of labor is simultaneously an attack on African American workers. While this attack on the living conditions of the people has been going on, the Reagan-Bush administrations have been packing the federal judiciary, not just the Supreme Court, with right-wing ideologues, including some weirdo African-Americans, in order to provide constitutional justification for the most repressive decisions and laws passed in the past 60 years. Electorally, this period has been marked by the rise of legitimization of the ultra-right. The David Dukes, Kirk Fortas's, that's the governor-elect of Mississippi, and Patrick Buchanan's are but the point men. The David Duke campaign brings to the fore a number of particular problems. The fact that the economy of Louisiana is in a near-depression state is significant, because the entire country may be in a similar situation by next November. Within that context, Patrick Buchanan's are but the point men. The David Duke campaign brings to the fore a number of particular problems. The fact that the economy of Louisiana is in a near-depression state is significant, because the entire country may be in a similar situation by next November. Within that context, Duke received a majority of the white vote. This demonstrates that whites of all income levels and classes are still very susceptible to racist demagogia. In fact, if it were not for a near unanimous and extraordinarily high African-American vote, Duke would be in the governor's mansion in Baton Rouge. In many cases, the African-American community can find allies in the organized labor movement when confronted by attack from the ultra-right. Although the United Auto Workers, among others, rendered important help, the organized labor movement in Louisiana is simply too small to be a major factor. Had they been of comparable size and influence of unions in the North, they may have been able to influence enough of the white vote to prevent Duke from even getting in the runoff. And of course, the comparably small size of the organized labor movement in Louisiana, like throughout the South, is in no small measure due to stringent right-to-work laws that are prevalent in that region. Once again, this shows that the rights of the African American people and the rights of labor of the labor movement are linked. The Duke campaign serves to legitimize similar policies enunciated by so-called mainstream politicians. This was highlighted by John Sununu, Bush's former chief of staff, whose comment on the Duke campaign was that it was the right message, but the wrong messenger. This is a harbinger of the 1992 campaign that will likely reflect the Klan sans sheets and the Nazis without the swastikas. While this turn to the right was occurring domestically, a similar phenomenon was occurring in foreign relations. The Reagan administration launched the biggest military buildup in history, and while a great deal of money was used on nuclear weapons in an attempt to intimidate the socialist countries, much was also used to finance wars of counter-revolution all across the globe. In Angola, Nicaragua, Ethiopia, and countless other so-called low-intensity wars, imperialism went on the offensive. In Grenada, a revolution was reversed. Thousands of lives were needlessly lost, and liberation movements, which had always found a friend in the socialist countries, were forced to rely more heavily on foreign assistance or were forced to retreat. And this war against developing countries is continuing. The enforced blockade of Cuba, the saber-rattling against North Korea, and most recently the Persian Gulf War show that imperialism fully intends to make use of the ground that it won. The socialist countries could not afford countless wars on every continent. In addition to the costs which have had adversely affected their ability to improve their own people's well-being, the threat of a local conflict flaring into a nuclear war was an ever-present danger. The socialist countries and the National Liberation Movement made concessions. But even these concessions were made by socialist countries that were far from economically and politically healthy. It was a weakened socialism in Europe that was incapable of standing up to the recent onslaught of imperialism. Although the weaknesses affected all of the Eastern European socialist countries to one degree or another, I will limit my discussion to the Soviet Union, which in many respects provided a model drawn on by the other socialist countries. The root of that weakness lay in the command administrative style of work that pervaded the political and economic system. It was a style institutionalized under former Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. This command administrative system had a near total disregard for the participation and contribution of the masses, while substituting in their place the wisdom of a supreme leader or group of leaders. This system manifested itself most critically in three areas: the handling of the national question, economic management, and an underestimation of the resiliency of capitalism. The official position in the Soviet Union for some time had been that the national question was solved. The pronouncement of the resolution was typical of the command administrative system. A great announced it was solved. Everybody congratulated themselves. Academics dutifully wrote learned treatises on solving the national question, and everybody would have lived happily ever after, except for one small problem. The national question was not solved. Although definite advances had been made, and we cannot underestimate them, the national question was far from solved. Was pushed under the guise of internationalism or the new socialist community of nations. Republic and local leaders, eager to please their cohorts in Moscow, cited statistics on increasing bilingualism and intermarriage to support their contention that numerically smaller nationalities were declining, as was nationalism as a political force. At the same time, we must recognize that national cultures and national languages did flourish even under this policy. However, the formerly oppressed nationalities were circumscribed from protesting Russification under the fear of being branded narrow nationalists or anti-Soviet. Of course, as we all know, as soon as undemocratic restrictions were lifted, a large number of areas in the Soviet Union turned into virtual war zones between feuding nationalities. This explosion was inevitable given the bureaucratic approach to the national question. The resulting national discord served to weaken the Soviet Union and socialism. The mistakes in carrying out a Leninist nationalist policy provided an opening for narrow nationalist and anti-socialist forces. The same type of problems manifested themselves in the area of the economy. Decisions on production were made without concern for the market, but based solely on numbers dreamed up by top managers in Moscow. There was no attention paid to distribution, a continuing major problem in the Soviet Union. Many products were manufactured with no way to get them to consumers. Since market forces were totally disregarded, according to a caricaturized version of Marx in economics, the quality of the products were irrelevant. Soviet goods, in some cases, were too inferior for export and not particularly desired by the Soviet people themselves. Marx wrote that you could not operate solely based on the law of supply and demand. But he noted that the law of supply and demand was one of the factors that determines price. It cannot be ignored. Once again, according to the command administrative style, managers were more interested in fulfilling their plan than in fulfilling their supposed function. If it looked good on paper, no matter the reality, that was fine. It was in this atmosphere that corruption found a home. Let me run quickly. Imperialism militarily spent the socialist countries into an economic crisis. The policies of perestroika and glasnost, introduced under the leadership of Mikhail Gorbachev, were devised to solve many of these problems. Many people have mistakenly drawn a causal relationship between the introduction of these policies and the problems. Although Glasnost certainly made the problems more visible to the outside, the problems were there long before Glasnost. As Marxist-Leninists, we believe there is an objective material reality that exists independent of our perceptions. However, many who call themselves Marxist-Leninists revert to subjective idealism with respect to the crisis in socialism. They seem to think that since they didn't know about the problems didn't exist until Gorbachev came along. Nothing could be further from the truth. While one probably critiques many of the tactical decisions in the unfolding of Perestroika and Glasnost, the bottom line is that it was clearly overwhelmed by the opposition. What was unforeseen is that the opposition would come from two different sectors. Those who were in favor of maintaining the status quo, much of this opposition was located in the Communist Party bureaucracy, and those who favored a return to capitalism. This unholy alliance combined to derail the efforts to reform society in a more democratic manner. The collapse of socialism has had a tremendously negative impact on the world. Although socialism still exists in Cuba, North Korea, Vietnam, and China, the most developed economies are headed towards capitalist restoration. I'm just going to skip a couple of things. In the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx wrote that of all the classes that stand face to face with the bourgeoisie today, the proletariat alone is a really revolutionary class. That still holds true. The working class is the only class that, in fulfilling its own class responsibilities, can uplift the entire society. Marx coined the phrase, workers of the world unite. Later appended by Lenin, who added, workers and oppressed peoples of the world unite. That is still an essential framework for carrying out any progressive social transformation. The unity and alliance between the oppressed nationalities and the working class is more important than ever. The strengthening of imperialism with its increased ability to maneuver holds dire consequences for the democratic rights of the people in this country. And it is in this fight to defend, restore, and expand democracy that the requisite unity will be built between the oppressed nationalities and the working class, and within the oppressed nationalities themselves. The fight to ensure the democratic rights of the people is not alien to the fight for socialism. In fact, it is an inalienable part of that fight. Lenin noted, it would be a radical mistake to suppose that the struggle for democracy can divert the proletariat from the socialist revolution or obscure it or overshadow it. On the contrary, just as socialism cannot be victorious unless it introduces complete democracy, so the proletariat will be unable to prepare for victory over the bourgeoisie unless it wages a many-sided, consistent, and revolutionary struggle for democracy, in the quote from Lenin. A time of reaction highlights the importance of democratic reform. In addition, reaction breeds its opposite, the fight back against reaction. But its victory is not guaranteed. It must be organized. The African-American community is probably more politicized today than it has been in the past 30 years. The increasing acceptance of Malcolm X as an uncompromising fighter for the rights of African-Americans and other oppressed people is a gauge of the political maturity of the African-American people. But we live in a different time than Malcolm's. We have at our disposal tools that we did not have 30 years ago. We have an increasingly powerful Congressional Black Caucus that has acted as a legislative bulwark in the fight against reaction. We have an expanding intelligentsia whose skills can be, not necessarily are, brought to bear in the service of democracy and freedom. We have a growing coalition of black trade unionists acting as a link between organized labor and the African-American community and playing a leadership role in both areas. There is a spontaneous level of unity in the African-American community that has not existed in years. It is a unity against imperialism, against racism, against the right-wing thrust of the Bush administration, and against the discordant voices of the so-called black neoconservatives. This spontaneous unity must be strengthened through struggle for it to achieve its goals. We will continue to have differences, and that's healthy. But if Malcolm's legacy means anything, it must stand for an unceasing desire to build unity in the African-American community as a first line of defense against those who would oppress it. I am a communist. You may be a nationalist, a socialist, a pan-Africanist, or whatever. But to paraphrase Malcolm, that ain't why we're catching hell.